Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do teachers in Poland, Finland, and South Korea know about education that American educators do not? And more importantly, what skills are their students mastering that kids in the U.S. don't have down? My guest today wanted to understand how schools work in these countries, in part because they have come so far in the global rankings in recent years and notably have helped cultivate complex thinking and creativity along with teaching facts. So she followed three U.S. teenagers who went abroad to those countries as exchange students and uses their experience as a lens through which to view what is really working in the world's leading education systems. Amanda Ripley writes for publications including The Atlantic and Time magazine, and she's an Emerson Fellow at the New America Foundation. Her new book is called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. She joins us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Amanda, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You write that you spent much of your reporting career trying to avoid education stories. What changed your attitude?
Well, I am a little embarrassed to say that I thought that education stories were too soft, that they were also impossible to fix, you know, that seemed like a problem you couldn't get your hands around. And then about 5 years ago, I was assigned a profile on Michelle Rhee, who was the new controversial head of public schools in Washington, D.C. And I knew very little, but I knew that she wore stiletto heels and she said crap a lot in interviews. And she was just really kind of fearless. So I figured it'd be an interesting story. And it was. But what I learned in doing that story was that education was actually a total riot of data and mythology and conflict and emotion. And it was fascinating. And I had totally underestimated it.
When we talk about stagnant academic performance in the U.S. relative to other countries, what kinds of achievements, what kinds of skills are being measured?
Good question. I mean, I think you need to look at more than one measurement, right, to do this in a sane way. One thing you obviously want to look at is what percentage of kids are graduating from high school, what percentage are graduating from college, since we know so many good things go along with that for the rest of your life. Another thing that I found to be particularly revealing was a test called the PISA test, which is administered by the OECD to 70 countries around the world every 3 years to a representative sample of all 15-year-olds in public school and private school. And it was designed about 13 years ago explicitly to try to measure your ability to not memorize knowledge, but to apply it to solve problems you've never seen before, to make an argument, and to really think in math, reading, and science. So I did take the PISA test just to be sure it was the real deal, and I was pretty impressed by it. And so that is one of the main measurements that I used.
So obviously it's important, you know, knowledge and skills are important, but that creativity, that ability to think creatively is important. And so you wanted to look at countries where students were demonstrating ability in complex thinking rather than simply sort of parroting back what they were taught in a textbook.
Right. And this PISA test is not perfect, but it's the best tool I've seen to try to get at that very valuable, powerful skill set you're talking about, which has a lot to do with getting really fluent in math, for example, instead of just memorizing equations and formulas. And, you know, being able to make an argument in long-form writing, which the PISA also measures. Because we know that these kinds of things will hold you in good stead as the economy changes around you, because it helps you to learn and to adapt.
What did you find, just looking at the United States, with regard to high school? We sort of think of that in some ways as a means to an end. You know, like high school is means something different to students who are college bound than to students who are not.
And historically, that's worked out okay for us. I mean, I think part of the reality here is that we haven't really needed for most of our kids to get an incredibly rigorous, thoughtful, intentional education academically. That hasn't been a requirement for our economic success. And that is shifting as the economy shifts, as more jobs are automated, as more jobs are globalized. So this is sort of something that you can understand. There's a lag time in coming to this realization in the U.S.
Yeah, so you can't just graduate from high school, get a good job down at the mill, and assume you'll retire from that comfortably in 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, things have changed pretty dramatically You know, you can't work as a garbage collector in New York City without a high school degree or join the Air Force. Many, many people who take the military's assessment test to join fail. I think it's about a third. And you find that, you know, with 40% of people who go to community college ending up in remedial classes, they're not actually getting as prepared as they thought in high school.
So the three countries that you focus on, South Korea, Poland, and Finland, are notable in part for the speed of their turnarounds. Can you just give us a basic picture of each of these countries a few decades ago?
Yeah, this is actually really wild because, you know, in the 1950s, Finland had a 10% high school graduation rate. 10%.
That's
again.
Amazing.
So, yeah, now they're up near 90% and we're in the upper 70s. You know, what's happened is we've kind of stayed the same with a slight uptick depending on what age group you're looking at or what subject. But most other countries have seen dramatic changes over time, which I thought was incredibly encouraging because, if you look around, you start to see that change is possible. And the same is true in South Korea, which was, you know, coming out of a war and just a highly illiterate place in the 1950s. When they were inventing, when they were enrolling kids in high school at that point, which they hadn't done much of before, they had to actually, you know, invent new words for scientific terms because the textbooks didn't have them. So, you know, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, and the best example of that really is Poland because they have been going through this transition in real time. So in the late 1990s, Poland underwent a series of pretty intense education reforms. And they went from scoring below average on this PISA test I was talking about to above average and now outscore our own teenagers in science despite spending 50% per student what we spend.
So, you know, it really does speak to how far we haven't come if we were so far ahead for such a long time and we really haven't made significant gains. Talk about some of the differences that you observed and that your students observed with regard to how teenagers themselves view their own responsibilities in school.
This is a huge deal, how other kids think about school and how that affects everybody else, because it's contagious. And that's why I was really, really lucky to have these students to follow, because as an adult, you forget about how powerful this peer effect is. But all three students that I followed all noticed that other students in their classes abroad seem to care more about school. They seem to buy into the premise of it. Even, you know, not to say they were all sort of young intellectual scholars. You know, they were very similar to kids back home. But, you know, when Kim went to Finland, she noticed that the kids, the girls who were texting on their phones in the back and going to parties and otherwise pretty similar to kids back home were still taking it seriously, still doing their work and studying for their tests and, you know, really kind of engaged in a way that they weren't even in her honors classes back in Oklahoma.
Yeah, and we should say all three of the students that you follow were good students and are good students back at home. It's not like they were sort of run-of-the-mill students.
Well, yes and no. Two of the three had serious problems in math and continue to struggle with that, which was coincidental because that is the area in which American teenagers show the biggest weakness across the board at every income level is math. So in some ways, yeah, they were particularly curious about the world around them. They were not all, you know, rich kids. They were not all very privileged kids, but they were curious about the world around them and for various reasons not satisfied with their high school experience and wanted to go somewhere else.
Okay, so South Korea is really interesting in that there's school and then there's what happens after school, which matters almost as much.
Yeah, it's actually something that Eric, who came from Minnesota and went to South Korea for a year, was just baffled by when he first, literally his first day of school. I mean, he'd gone to actually a very high-performing suburban public high school outside of Minneapolis. Minnesota has one of the best education results in the country for the U.S. And he went from there to South Korea, which is the top of the world. So it's an interesting point of comparison. He thought he knew, you know, coming from the U.S., from a very high-performing school, he thought he knew about high-stakes tests and pressure and kids who stressed out. And it turns out, you know, it's like when you play JV all your life, JV soccer, and I say this from experience, and then you get one day you get pulled up to varsity and you're like, oh, no.
I'm in the show now. Yeah,
yeah, it's a totally different level you didn't know about. And it's like it's kind of intimidating. So this is what he discovered, is these kids were working all day long in school, just a longer school day typically than the U.S., but, you know, all day long. And then 70% of Korean teenagers would then go to after-school tutoring academies, which literally repeat the entire day, all the subjects in schools that look a lot like regular schools, but you pay a fee for them. And the kids who didn't do that basically studied at school on their own until late into the night. There's actually a curfew in Korea where beyond which kids are not allowed to stay out at these private sector schools studying. And there's a crackdown squad and the whole deal. I mean, it's wild. So he saw that the kids are actually going to school twice, and it's an incredibly inefficient and grueling way to get to the top of the world.
How does that kind of pressure affect students' psyches?
Every Korean student I met complained about that system. They were not happy, particularly in high school. I mean, it's not quite as insane in the younger years. They were not happy about it. The parents were not happy about it. The teachers were not happy. Nobody was happy. The education minister wasn't happy. So everybody said, this is not a good model. Go to Finland. But they had trouble disrupting it. If you imagine inelastic demand for education, that's what it looks like in Korea, which actually is a really fascinating laboratory. You know, I mean, it's not great if you have to live there as a kid, but it is a fascinating place to watch what happens when an entire society overestimates what kids can do academically as opposed to underestimates, which is what I see in many places in the U.S.
Yeah, it seems in some ways that we are so afraid of having our kids feel bad about themselves that we just lower the bar on a lot of things, including like personal responsibility for their own work.
Yeah, you know, kids admit this, actually. Half of American kids say that their history homework is too easy in high school, for example. Or only half are always or almost always learning in math class in high school. So this is something that they pretty consistently agree with. In fact, I ended up surveying hundreds of exchange students to see if what the three students I followed were telling me, if that was reflected in a broader population. And there was pretty unanimous agreement that the classes in America were easier. Even the American students who went abroad agreed that the American classes were easier, which isn't to say that they were worse necessarily, but they're just less rigorous typically.
Well, and it's funny too, we talk so much about high-stakes testing and we worry about the effect, but very often we pin it all on the teachers and leave students feeling like it may or may not matter so much how they do.
It's a weird combination of things, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, you know, kids are supposed to sort of receive education. Like, it's just supposed to bathe in it. They go into school and they get it or they don't get it. But we also have a weird thing in the U.S. that I didn't see elsewhere and kind of helps to get away in order to recognize this. But where, you know, if kids aren't good at math, they're kind of – they start thinking they're just not good at math, right? You do not see that in Korea and Finland, where there's an assumption that it's like reading. If you're not good at reading, then you need help and you need to practice. You need to work on it and then you'll get better. And that's the absolute built-in embedded assumption, which makes a huge difference. So in that sense, yeah, kids are held to a higher standard because there's less of an emphasis on IQ and innate talent and more on hard work.
Which makes sense because nobody says, for example, not everybody learns how to speak English or whatever in an English-speaking country, but we do treat math that way.
It's weird, yeah, and science, actually.
My guest is journalist Amanda Ripley. She's an Emerson Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. You can be part of the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Amanda Ripley. She's an Emerson Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. What did you learn, Amanda, about the ways that teachers and their work are esteemed in different parts of the world as compared with the U.S.?
We always hear that, you know, teachers are highly respected in Finland, and that's part of the secret of their success. But the interesting question is, why?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't always that way, despite what you sometimes hear. I think that has grown significantly over time. And the reason it's grown is because in the late 1960s, Finland shut down its teacher training colleges, which were of wildly varying quality, like ours are today, and reopened them in the top 8 elite universities in Finland. And this was part of a broader set of reforms, but they were under economic pressure, and they were worried about becoming irrelevant, and they knew that they had very few natural resources. So it made sense to really buckle down and get very serious about education. And if you're going to get serious about anything that's really hard, then of course you would start at the beginning, right, by making sure that the people who are teaching are themselves highly educated so that the training you give them can be more relevant and rigorous. And from there, you get this beautiful kind of virtuous cycle where, you know, you send a signal to everyone, parents, teachers, politicians, especially kids, about how serious you are. Because those kids I met in Finland, they knew. They all knew, it was just as a matter of course, that their teachers, to become a teacher in Finland today, to get into the universities that do this, is like getting into MIT in the U.S. So it lends a kind of legitimacy to the claims about education is important and all these, you know, cliches we hear. That's real. Like, that's walking the walk, right?
What struck me reading about that, Amanda, was that in this country, this is not entirely the case, and we do have, you know, sort of Ivy League schools that teach education, but many people would consider it a waste, and I'm using air quotes here, to go to an Ivy League school and then become a teacher.
Right. So you see, this is the cycle, the negative feedback
we're stuck
in. We have over 1,000 different teacher training colleges in the United States, and most of them are not at all selective, and we educate twice as many teachers as we need. Hmm. So we have systematically gone about this in a kind of slapdash fashion. There are some great teacher training colleges, but, you know, many of them assume that the candidates who come to them will not necessarily themselves be good students. I think they have to have like a C average on average, but they can be below average on their SAT scores for the country. And, you know, there's kind of built into those assumptions a sense that education does not actually need to be rigorous and teaching is not actually all that hard, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. How do you disrupt that cycle? I do think it's odd that not a single state, all the fights we've had about education, all the things we've done. I mean, some districts have essentially taken out tenure, which was unimaginable just 10 years ago. And no state that I know of has done this. No state has said, and they do regulate the heck out of these teacher training colleges, but they never say, okay, you really are not going to be able to let in anyone who's not exceptionally well-educated themselves. And there are reasons why they don't do that. Usually the pushback is, well, if you do that, you won't have a diverse teaching pool. And this is interestingly also pushback that happened in Finland, which, you know, you think, well, Finland's all white. What are they worried about diversity? But they were worried about rural versus urban. And they wanted to make sure the common man, as they put it, could still become a teacher. So there was a real divide about this. And there was a big argument about it at the time. As it turns out, the few states that have just slightly increased the bar for teacher training colleges, like Rhode Island's an example, they do not find that they lose minority candidates. In fact, they may gain minority candidates over time because the prestige increases once you make it harder to join, and particularly for men. I mean, prestige is a form of compensation. You know, it's not just about money. And so, you know, if you want to attract more people to this profession, then, you know, this is one way of doing it relatively cheaply.
And then these places are also able to offer more autonomy to teachers because they can trust that they're all qualified, which is something that I think frustrates well-qualified teachers here in the U.S. Very often, they are subject to the same really restrictive regulations designed to sort of lift up the teachers who may be less qualified.
Right. You know, we have a lack of trust in the system. And whenever you have a complex organization with a lack of trust for the employees, you get these top-down, accountability-based, ham-fisted measures to try to control what people do. And you can never really achieve exceptional results in any field with that approach. I think you'd agree, probably for the work that you and I do, if someone was constantly over our shoulder, counting what we're doing, telling us exactly what to do, and there was just kind of built-in distrust, then, you know, it's really hard to innovate and have the freedom and autonomy that real professionals deserve.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Barbara in Arlington who says she was an exchange student in Finland a number of years ago and attended school there for a full year. She wants to know how you think the Finnish national defining characteristic of sisu influences school outcomes.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad that she asked
it
that.
It comes up in the book, yeah.
yeah, but it's a fairly obscure. I usually don't talk about it on the radio because it's like, sisu, what the heck? But
it's cool, though.
Let's do it. Yeah, it's totally awesome. So it's a word that's hard to translate, but it's deeply steeped in the history and culture of Finland. And it basically means grit, persistence, you know, the wherewithal to continue even when something is hard. That, we know, is more valuable in life than IQ. There's a lot of research on that at this point. So this is a really cool thing that you see manifest itself in different ways in Finland. And you also see it in other countries, by the way, in different forms. But one thing you see is that kids have more autonomy. They have more freedom over their time. Kim, who came from Oklahoma, she could routinely leave school. She had a break, which she often did, go into the little town and have coffee. This really freaked her out, by the way, at first because, you know, she kept thinking she's going to get busted, you know, because in U.S. high schools, that's pretty unusual. So there is more freedom. Kids walk to school from a very young age. Different reasons for that, of course, and you can't do that in every American town for different reasons. But nevertheless, there is this real sense that kids need to develop a certain mental toughness. And one thing you see is, you know, a lot fewer trophies. For example, the press secretary to the Finnish embassy here in Washington told me that his daughter, you know, he was living here with his family, his young daughter, who I think was 9, had more trophies from her time in America playing soccer than his brother-in-law, who was a professional ice hockey player in Finland. So you see there's this real tendency to praise and worry about kids' self-esteem, and that does not, and the research is very clear on this, does not lead to sisu.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Rick in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Hi, my comment was, and it leads to a question, is that I've often wondered why South Korea and Finland scored so highly in countries like that, and one of the things I've thought was that the homogeneity of their society leads their systems to spend more money on poor districts and poor people that look like them and are like them, whereas in countries, the Western countries that are polyglot and have many different types of people, there's more of a reluctance to spend money in those areas where the people aren't like you. And then the other point I would make is that in the good districts in the United States, they score much higher. And if you just cut the bottom 10% out, sort of like General Electric does every year, you would see that we actually do score pretty well, you know, in certain areas.
Thanks so much for your call. Amanda, do you want to respond to all that?
Great questions. If you take the richest quartile, the top 25% of American 15-year-olds, and compare them to the richest quartile of kids around the world, who, by the way, are not as rich, typically, you find that they perform about 18th in the world in math. So in math and science in particular, there is something systemic going on beyond poverty and race. That said, I agree, of course, that poverty matters a great deal. Diversity matters. Interestingly, most of our kids are not going to school in diverse schools. They go to school in places where everybody looks like they do, which I would argue is part of our problem. So we're not – it's hard to set a school up to succeed if it's 90% low-income kids or 70%. You know, it's much easier to manage all of those challenges if it's less than 50%, although not impossible. So I do think that the way we distribute resources in the U.S. is different from the top-performing countries. In many states, it is. It does end up de facto being based on income. So the more wealthy neighborhoods end up with more well-resourced, well-funded schools. That is shifting a little in some places, but that is definitely a part of our problem. I would just end this answer by saying one interesting question that was what provoked me to go on this global quest was looking at a state-by-state comparison to countries. And if you do that, you know, we have some very white, very homogenous, very well-to-do states, actually, like New Hampshire, which is 96% white and has the highest median income in the country. And yet 15-year-olds there are not performing anywhere near. 15-year-olds at the top of the world are coming in closer to kids in Portugal in math. So you can see there's a lot going on here.
Let's talk about math, because we know we have a problem, right? Most people would agree to that. So we keep making the textbooks longer. But one thing I had never thought about before reading the work that you had done is how siloed we make the different forms of mathematics that we encourage our kids to study.
Eric noticed this coming from Minnesota, which, again, has pretty good math scores. And he goes to South Korea. And, yeah, he complained about how long and hard the kids worked. But he loved math class in Korea. He noticed right away that, you know, they were integrating trigonometry, geometry, some calculus, algebra, all at once, which I also had never really thought about. But when you think about math as a language, it's really a language of logic. And if you would never study Italian by just doing verbs 1 year, right, and nouns the next year, it's much – I mean, you could.
It would be awful.
But it would be painful, yeah. Right? And I think, you know, it's much more interesting if your teachers have the math background and the support from their principal and all those other things. If they have all that, it's much more interesting to teach it in a more integrated way. And I will say, you know, 45 states, not Texas, although Texas has increased its standards recently, as you know, but 45 states have moved towards these Common Core state standards, which are actually more rigorous in math and look a lot more like Korea and Finland.
How often do you see parents roaming the halls of schools and selling cupcakes and that sort of thing in these three countries?
Another huge surprise. Never. You do not see parents in these schools. You know, it was wild because... here, you know, we talk a lot about the importance of parental involvement in education, and everyone can agree with that, right? But defining parental involvement is where you see huge differences from place to place. In these countries, like in Finland, let's take, for example, where Kim's host mother, who put her up for the year, she has two twin daughters in an elementary school. And I asked her, so what does your elementary school ask you to do for the school as a parent? And it was like she didn't understand the question.
Yeah.
You know, she was like, what do you mean? I have to take them to school. I have to get them there on time. And I said, did they ask you for money? And she was aghast. You know, she said, no, never. Did they ask you to you know, spiff up the building or hold bake sales or, you know, come and do things? And no. I mean, she almost wished they did, actually. But it's interesting because if you look at these countries and actually all around the world, the research that's been done suggests that the one thing that works in every country that helps kids learn to be critical thinkers and close readers who enjoy reading is to read to them almost every day when they're little, ask them questions as you're reading, and as they get older, talk to them about what they're reading, talk to them about their day at school, talk to them about the news of the events. And that is really strongly correlated with 15-year-olds who are strong readers and critical thinkers. But actually, volunteering extracurricular activities in school is often negatively related to reading performance of kids.
I know that you have heard from a lot of parents who are appalled by this, because many of them have spent the past, you know, 8 years or whatever putting in, you know, a second hour job kind of hours at their kids' schools. But why did that idea, spending time with our kids versus spending time sort of to benefit our kids at their schools, how did that pass us by, do you think?
You know, I think there is something to be said, obviously, for all these activities that we do and the sports and the bake sales. There is a real sense of community that comes from that. So you know, I don't mean to suggest that there's no value in that, but it should, it actually came as a relief to me as a parent to be able to prioritize these things. You know, there's just all these demands on you and you're not, you know, you're busy, you're not sure which ones to do and which ones to ignore. And knowing what actually leads to learning is really helpful, and we need just a little guidance, which some schools in America, some school leaders do give parents that guidance, but it's pretty rare. So, I mean, yeah, there are some people who are real upset. There's some mothers in particular who are like, oh, thank God, because I've been feeling terrible about, you know. So there's a mixed reaction to that. And but I think you need to be able to prioritize and say, well, you know, okay, I am able to find a way to read to my kid or get someone else to do it. You know, and we talk about their days and we do these things. And if there's time left over, then I will bake brownies. Great. You know, but having that focus is really helpful.
So here in Texas, we're coming up on football homecoming season, which is, you know, about as close to like the secular form of High Holy Days as we get in this state. And many people sort of think back fondly to their high school years and all the games they went to and all the sports they played. That is not a major element in schools in the three countries that you studied.
All the kids I followed noticed this right away. The other kids in these countries did play sports. You know, they played pickup soccer or ice hockey in Finland, but they did it. It was totally separate from school. It might be in the community rec center or through parents or just, you know, informal pickup games. And when I surveyed hundreds of exchange students about this, they all agreed, a majority agreed, that sports were much more important to U.S. teenagers than kids abroad. And yes, of course, this is even more emotional of a controversial of a subject than volunteering in school. You know, I played soccer my whole life. It was important to me, but it, again, is a function of priorities and balancing this out so that academics are first.
My guest is journalist Amanda Ripley. We're talking about her new book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. This is part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to join this conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Amanda Ripley, an Emerson Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Amanda, we've talked about what it takes to get through high school in places like Finland, Poland, and South Korea. What does it take to get out of high school?
All three countries have, like most developed countries, a very clear, particularly high-performing countries, a very clear, bright finish line. So there's a challenging test at the end upon which your chances of getting into university are based. And so it's really interesting because this has been very controversial in the U.S. Many states have tried to have graduation tests. Many states do. But they aren't as challenging and demanding as these tests that happen in these countries. Let me give you a quick example. So in Finland, when you graduate from high school, your senior year, you take a very challenging exam. You don't take a lot of tests until then, a standardized test, that is. But then at the end, you take this test that lasts 50 hours, 5-0, over the course of weeks and involves extensive writing and thinking and reasoning. And is, you know, a real challenge and very, very stressful sometimes for kids and for teachers. But you see, that's a great example of how they seem to have invested very heavily in quality over quantity. So there are fewer standardized tests, but the ones they have are smarter. And I think the same is true with teachers, with homework. It's really focusing on quality and assuming kids can do more than you think, and then reducing quantity so that you have the money to do it.
I feel like I might just get struck by lightning asking you this question, but would it help to consider a national set of standardized tests in this country that would assume, that would ensure that the curriculum was the same, the things we were expecting students to have learned were the same?
It's funny you ask that, because 45 states and Washington, D.C. have adopted these Common Core state standards for what kids should know, which are more rigorous. They're in math and reading. And they really open up the way. There's two different groups working on tests related to these standards so that they're aligned. So they open up the path to, this is a prerequisite in mm-hmm. these countries that I'm talking about, to have this sort of clear, higher set of standards that allow teachers to go deeper into fewer things. So that's incredibly valuable. However, it's been hugely controversial, and many states are backing away from it for different reasons. But, you know, we are very distrustful of the federal government. The federal government, by the way, had nothing to do with writing these standards. It was all done at the state and local level on purpose. But still, there's a real sort of paranoia almost in some places about these standards, because they are common. So there's a fear that it'll somehow there'll be a loss of local control. And, you know, it's sort of yet to be seen how many states will succumb to those fears and how many will hold their ground.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Kevin in Denton. Hi, Kevin.
Howdy. Well, this is a subject very dear to my heart, as I pay a fortune in school taxes and don't see very much coming out. I know that I'm a little different because I had already begun my own business by the time I was in high school, but I feel that I feel like I was cheated out of 12 years of my life because there was nothing of any practical use that I learned in school. Nothing that worked, you know, whenever I got out. Now, I can imagine that now, 35 years later, that math and such as that is more important, but I just, you know, I wouldn't learn as much in one day of listening to public radio as what I did in a whole day, you know, in school. And I just feel like taxpayers are being cheated. I'll hire people that are just in high school or just out, and they can't tell you which way's up.
What do you think about that, Amanda? Well,
I
maybe you can.
There's,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think he's onto something. I think, you know, we should expect more. Look, we spend more per student than all but three countries in the world on K through 12 education. Everybody except Norway, Luxembourg, and Switzerland, and they spend almost the same as we do, which is to say a fortune. Now, where is that money going? Because, you know, schools feel very strapped for money, and I don't think they're lying. It's true. So where is that money going? This is an enduring mystery. One thing I will tell you, just to provoke more outrage, is that, you know, the research that's been done suggests that football costs four times per student what math costs per student. So that's just one example. I'm not saying we should do away with football, but there are lots of things that we spend money on that don't lead to this kind of engagement and rigor that your caller is talking about. And I would actually argue that maybe taxpayers are being cheated, although I don't know. I think of it more like millions of kids are being cheated, because they don't find out until usually after 18 that they actually did waste a lot of time in many cases, not all, but many cases. And then they suffer the consequences when it's a little late, you know, to find that out. So yeah, I think the outrage is not inappropriate, but channeling it towards a productive conversation is really, really important. When I surveyed hundreds of exchange students, a majority of them agreed that they saw way more technology in their U.S. classrooms, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting. We spent a huge amount of amount of money on making sure that every school is wired, every classroom is wired. This is not necessarily the case in schools that vastly outperform us.
Right. What a surprise. I mean, it is unexpected, right? Because we all feel like, oh, we need more technology in schools. It's just, you say it so much, it becomes, you think it's true. But then you have to kind of get a way to to question that assumption. The students I followed closely to Finland, Korea, and Poland all noticed on their very first day that there was a lot less technology in their schools abroad than back home. And there's been a lot of research to show that, you know, the technology we tend to invest in does not lead to learning, typically. It is not often worth the money. So asking those hard questions is something that taxpayers and parents should do.
Some of this seems to speak to a culture that is built around education or a culture that doesn't value education. And it's so funny because it seems in this country like we talk out of both sides of our mouths, right? We talk all the time about how we want to make education better. And yet, for some reason, we're producing kids that get to school that don't seem that into it. We're producing teachers who, for whatever reasons, are struggling to engage students. How do we get ourselves as a nation to think differently about education before we get to a place as students where, you know, we're sort of mature enough to understand how much it's really worth?
Well, I think it's more hopeful than sometimes it feels. I think we do value education in a lot of ways. Our kids do pretty well in reading, particularly at younger ages compared to kids around the world. It's really in math and science where we see this drop off, which is encouraging because it is possible. It means, you know. But I think starting at the beginning of the teaching profession might be one thing to really look hard at to elevate the seriousness of this. One thing I notice is that in these countries, you know, kids took school more seriously, and maybe that was just because school was more serious. So the Common Core State Standards or other high-level standards and not backing away from those and doing it. I mean, people do that for good reason. They don't want to demoralize kids. They don't want to make them feel bad. But the thing is, we're waiting until they're 18 to do that, you know. It'd be better to be honest with kids when they're younger, but do so in a mindset, and this is really important, where you assume they can get better and they just need help and they need to work harder. So once you assume that, then it doesn't have to be as demoralizing. You know, American 15-year-olds are number one in the world as far as percentage who say they get high grades in math. And yet we perform 26th in the world on a test of critical thinking in math. They're the same kids, by the way, so that are polled here. So, you know, we're not being honest with our kids. I think our kids are tougher than we think on academics, you know? I think if we could literally take the rhetoric and policies and practices that we approach sports with and do a find replace and apply them to math and science, we would be well on our way.
There's also less of a stigma in some of these places to special and remedial education, and it is not like a lifetime sentence. It's something that you do temporarily so that you can catch up.
Finland is really a leader in this. So from a very young age, as soon as they see that a kid is falling behind, it's like a pit crew descends on them, and they really devote a lot of resources, again, early on, which is much more cost effective to try to bring that child back up to speed. And what you find is that almost half of Finnish kids are in the category of special ed, getting special support at some point. So that then it loses its stigma, right, if it's that common. Because everybody, you know, has things that they struggle with or fall behind on, and you just want to nip that in the bud. The U.S., I should say, is actually pretty strong on special education compared to countries around the world and far superior to South Korea, from what I could tell. So, you know, we want to be careful. It's easy to get hyperbolic about this and think all is lost. But, you know, most countries also struggle to raise the bar for teaching and also struggle to not just say they value education, but actually prove it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Mark in Arlington. Hello, Mark.
Oh, hey, great subject. I appreciate you letting me ask a question.
Sure.
Do some of the schools overseas pre-test their kids to decide whether they gain access to their education? And if so, are we only being compared against those kids or their overall population?
Thanks for your call.
This is a really good question, and I'm glad you asked, because people ask me this way more than I thought. There is a belief out there that we are testing all our kids, and these other countries are only testing an elite group of their kids. That is not the case today. It may have been the case like 30 or 40 years ago when there were fewer kids in finishing high school in some of these countries. But today, the PISA test I'm talking about is a representative sample of all kids vocational, academic, what have you. And those other countries actually have a higher percentage of kids in their school system than we do at this point. So it is apples to apples to the degree that's possible. It includes private school. It includes public school. And they've worked very hard to try to make this a meaningful comparison, albeit one that's never going to be quite perfect. But, you know, your caller gets to a broader point, which is how do you divide kids into groups and when do you do that into people who are headed down the vocational path or the academic path? And what you find around the world consistently is that the later you wait to separate groups, separate kids and give them different content, the better everyone seems to do, which is really interesting. And I always thought that the U.S. didn't really track kids, that that was something that, you know, happened in Germany. But it turns out I was totally wrong, and we track kids earlier and more aggressively than most developed countries around the world. But we call it things like gifted and talented and honors classes, which leads to AP classes. And one thing leads to another in this scaffolding effect. And next thing you know, most of your day you're getting different content than the kid who sat next to you in kindergarten.
We're unique in that, or unusual among other countries, in that gifted to us feels like something you're like sort of born with and tapped on the head by a fairy with a star wand, as opposed to gifts being something that you can sort of work for and toward.
It's wild because I can't quite reconcile this, you know, with our rhetoric about individualism and meritocracy and all the great strengths that we do have as a country. How does that figure if we also are testing six-year-olds and deciding if they're gifted? I'm using air quotes since I found out I'm allowed to do that from you.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. Go for it.
Gifted. Okay. So, you know, I mean, you know, that's crazy. In this day and age, to label kids that way, all kinds of subconscious assumptions ensue from that gifted and talented label. I mean, you have private schools around this country who routinely administer IQ tests to 4- and 5-year-olds to decide if they're worthy. You know, this is nuts and has nothing to do with what the research shows us matters a lot, which isn't necessarily your aptitude for math at age 4, but things like self-control, persistence, curiosity, empathy, character. Those things can be taught, and so can math, of course.
Are schools in South Korea, Finland, and Poland any less bureaucratic than the ones here?
No, I don't think so. It was actually kind of amazing. There are some universal truths. People everywhere complain about their education system, just like healthcare.
Yeah.
And people everywhere complain about teacher unions. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, but, you know, principals and politicians. So, you know, many of our problems are universal, which is perversely reassuring.
It is. Journalist Amanda Ripley's new book is called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. She's an Emerson Fellow at the New America Foundation. Amanda, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Amanda Ripley joined us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and send comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.